You're listening to the podcast of Village Church in Burbank, California. To learn more about Village Church, visit our website at villagechurchburbank.org. We hope you enjoy today's message.
I'm ready to preach, as always. We are entering into a season today called Advent. This is a season given to us by the ancient church. It's at least 1,700 years old, as far as we can tell, the season of Advent. And during these 4 weeks of Advent, marked by the four Sundays leading to Christmas, so it begins today, this is the first Sunday of Advent, it's a season of waiting and yearning and longing for the arrival of the Messiah. I'll say more about that as we go. But the title of my sermon on this first Sunday of Advent is simply the phrase, keep awake. And it comes to us out of our passage this morning. Let's go ahead and look at Mark chapter 13, beginning in verse 32. This is Jesus speaking to his disciples. But about that day or hour, no one knows, neither the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Beware, keep alert. For you do not know when the time will come. It is like a man going on a journey when he leaves home and puts his slaves in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to be on watch. Therefore, keep awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening or at midnight or at cockcrow or at dawn, or else he may find you asleep when he comes suddenly. And what I say to you, I say to all, keep awake. He keeps saying that. I kind of get the feeling it's important. Keep awake. This is part of a conversation, a long conversation Jesus has with his disciples that we refer to as the Olivet Discourse. It happens during his final week there in Jerusalem. Within a couple days, Jesus will be crucified. And on this particular day, he's been teaching in the temple. And when it's time to leave, he leaves the temple complex, and he and his disciples, they go across the Kidron Valley, and they begin to walk up the Mount of Olives. That's why we call it the Olivet Discourse, fancy title. But they're there on the Mount of Olives, and they begin to look back upon the city of Jerusalem. The Temple Mount's right in front of them. It's a postcard view. To this day, it's stunning, and I'm sure it was on that day as well. But they're looking at the temple right in front of them. And his disciples are marveling at the architecture and the buildings of the Temple Mount and surrounding. And Jesus essentially tells them, enjoy this view while you have it, because all of this is going to come down very soon. In fact, not a stone's going to be left on top of another. And of course, his disciples are curious, and it sparks a question, when is this going to happen? When is the temple going to be destroyed? And how will we know? What are the signs that lead up to that event? How will we know when it's about to take place? And so what follows is this long discourse where Jesus begins kind of giving them a glimpse prophetically into what's going to happen within their lifetimes. The destruction of the temple and everything that's leading up to this. Is it going to be a time of political chaos and natural disasters? There's a lot of crazy things that will happen in the decade leading up to 70 AD. Now, we looked at all of that in depth 2 weeks ago in my sermon, The End of the World as We Know It. So I don't want to re-preach that. However, one part of the Olivet Discourse that I don't remember if we highlighted 2 weeks ago, but I do want to highlight for you now because it's applicable to Advent, is that Jesus, he does speak to them about the arrival, the appearance of the Son of Man. You know, if you know the Gospels, you know that this is Jesus' favorite title for himself. He has claimed that title, Son of Man. Now, what is this title? Where did it come from? It doesn't originate with Jesus. The title Son of Man is particularly connected to the Old Testament book of Daniel, written something like 100, 200, 300 years earlier. Somewhere, they're not sure, but somewhere about 200 or 300 years earlier than this conversation. And in Daniel 7, we read about this vision that he has, and he sees a figure, and he describes him as one like a son of man. It's a mysterious figure. But it's very clear as you read it that whoever this son of man is, it's a human being to whom God has given dominion over the nations. So a couple centuries later, Jesus claims that for himself, and he says, I'm that guy that Daniel saw in that vision. I am that Son of Man. And so the coming of the Son of Man is Jesus bringing the reign and rule of God to humanity. So Jesus says things like, the Son of Man will sit upon his glorious throne. But if you're not careful, you're going to miss that. The glorious throne of the Son of Man is his cross. That's how the kingdom of God comes. We serve a king whose coronation was by crucifixion. You know, when you see a painting, an artistic depiction of the crucifixion scene, what you're seeing is the coronation of our king. He's sitting on his throne with the crown on his head, crown of thorns. And those who are crucified next to them are those who sit on the thrones to his right and left. You remember just a few days earlier, James and John, they say, Jesus, we know you're going to Jerusalem and we know you're going to be crowned king. Well, he is. They just don't realize how. But they're like, hey, when you come into your kingdom, can we sit on the thrones to your right and left? And Jesus is like, you guys don't know what you're asking. You're asking to be crucified next to me because that's how I'm going to come into my kingdom. So that's his glorious throne. Now, after the Son of Man was enthroned by crucifixion and glorified in resurrection, he sends out his emissaries, his messengers of the kingdom, and they begin going out north, south, east, west, and they begin to announce the arrival of this kingdom, and they begin calling people, inviting people into his reign. This is what the gospel is. And Jesus says that all of these events will precede the destruction of the temple and the great suffering that it will entail. And in the Olivet Discourse, he gives them warnings. He tells them, when you begin to see these things happening, get out, get out, get out, get out of the city. And by the way, that's exactly what history tells us happened. Ancient non-Christian historians tell us that whenever the Romans marched upon Jerusalem leading up to 70 AD, largely it was the Christians who fled the city. Because they remembered the words of Jesus. They remembered the prophecy from decades earlier, and they fled the city just like he told them to do, and they went across the Jordan. Everybody else stayed in the city. Most everybody else stayed in the city. The Christians fled across the Jordan into the city of Pella. All of that's very well documented. So this is the tribulation that was the end of the world as they knew it. The end of the temple age when everything changed. And remember, Jesus said specifically these events would happen within their generation. Look at verse 30, just a bit before the passage we read. He says, truly, he says this in AD 30, around AD 30. Truly, I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place. So within a generation after Jesus' death, 40 years later, Jerusalem was destroyed, and it brought an end to what we might call the Old Testament world. And it was the dawn of the kingdom of Christ. And the Olivet Discourse primarily is about this inauguration, this beginning, this commencement of Christ's kingdom. But we also apply this passage to his appearing at the end of the age, what we call the second coming, or sometimes it's referred to as the second advent. Let's talk about that word Advent in the season of Advent. The word Advent comes from the Latin word Adventus, and it just means the arrival, the arrival. And Advent, if we understand Advent, there is a past, present, and future connection. So first of all, let me explain. Advent, first of all, connects us to the past. In the centuries leading up to the birth of Christ, it was hard times for God's people, the Jewish people, for hundreds of years. I mean, it had been hard times for a long time, hundreds of years. They've been ruled over, overpowered, dominated, and exploited by foreign empires. Think about how disorienting that must have been and how embarrassing it must have been. That here we are, we're God's people. You want to see yourself, we're God's people. We're God's chosen nation. The true God, the living God, the God who actually exists. We're his people. And yet for centuries, you've been ruled over and dominated by pagan powers. And yet all throughout those centuries, every so often, these inspired Jewish prophets, they would catch a glimpse of what is to come, and they would begin to proclaim it. They would say, listen, we know it's a hard time right now, but there's coming a time God's going to raise up a Messiah, a king, an anointed one. Daniel calls him the Son of Man. God's going to raise this person up, and somehow or another, through this person, the reign of God is going to come over the whole earth, and it's going to be an eternal kingdom of peace and righteousness. So in the midst of all of the turmoil and the heartache and the shame, God's people were yearning and longing for and waiting for the advent, the arrival of this Messiah. So during the season of Advent, we are connected to the past. We enter into that story and we experience it for ourselves. We join ourselves in solidarity to Israel, waiting for, longing for the birth of Christ. And that's why during Advent, we pay particularly close attention to the prophets like Isaiah and Micah, who are always talking about this arrival that's going to happen. So Advent connects us to the past. There's also a sense, though, in which Advent connects us to the future. Here we are now at the end of 2024, and I think we can all agree the world's pretty messed up, right? The world's pretty broken in a myriad of ways. It's beyond human repair. But as Christians, we confess, as we always have, He will come again to judge the living and the dead. He's going to come and set things right. I don't know about you. I am yearning for and longing for and waiting for the advent, the second advent, the coming of Jesus. How many of y'all are looking forward to that? All right, wonderful. So Advent connects us to the past. Advent connects us to the future. But living in the present, we also look for the appearing of Christ in our everyday lives right now. If we will keep awake, if we will stay alert, if we will keep our eyes open, that's what we have to do. We have the possibility of discovering Christ appearing in our lives right now, today. In his teaching in the Gospels, Jesus constantly, he'll give exhortations to people. He'll say things like, stay awake, keep alert, pay attention. He'll tell parables that have to do with keeping your lamps trimmed, keeping the oil in your lamps burning. He's constantly telling people, don't fall into slumber, but keep your eyes open. Why? Because it was very easy for people to fail to recognize what God was doing right in front of them. This is the sad and tragic tale of the Pharisees. I realize a lot of times we tend to caricaturize, that's always a hard word for me to say, caricaturize the Pharisees. And we just see them as nothing more than the villains in the Jesus story. And I get that. I understand that. But we have to understand there's also a sense in which the Pharisees are really a tragic story. Because they really were a group of people who, you could almost say, like more than anyone else, they were really yearning for God to fulfill his promises and bring the Messiah. I mean, their whole life was structured around being ready when Messiah comes, and yet when it was happening right in front of them, they completely missed it. But it wasn't just the Pharisees. One of the things I notice in the Gospels and just in my own life experience is that Jesus always comes to people in surprising, startling, shocking ways. I think of no less than John the Baptist. I tend to call him John the Baptizer just to avoid confusion. He wasn't like a Southern Baptist or something. He was a baptizer. That's what it means. But you know, John, I mean, just like anybody else, I mean, he was really yearning for the arrival of God's Messiah, and John actually knew who he was. And John paved the way for Messiah. He announced publicly that his cousin Jesus is the Messiah. But a bit later in the story, it seems as though John, just like most everybody, he had a very kind of defined job description of what he assumed the Messiah was going to be doing. I would guess that, like most people, he probably envisioned that Messiah is going to be some kind of warrior king like David or Judah Maccabee. And so when Jesus comes and he's not filling that job description, doesn't look like that, John's a little disoriented, disillusioned, and he's in his prison. And so he sends messengers out to Jesus asking, are you really the one? Are you the Messiah I've been telling people you are? Or should we be looking for someone else? Because Jesus was surprising John. The priests, the scribes, the religious professionals of Jesus' day, they couldn't imagine that a mere peasant from Galilee could actually become the king of Israel. So they failed to recognize Jesus for who he is. When Jesus appears to his disciples on the stormy sea of Galilee, they say it's a ghost. They couldn't quite recognize him. Mary Magdalene, on that first Easter Sunday morning in the garden, she turns around and she mistakes Jesus to be the gardener. Couldn't recognize him. The two disciples on the road to Emmaus, they're talking with Jesus the whole time. 7-mile walk, and the whole time they think he's a stranger. John the Revelator, he's told to look at Jesus. He turns around expecting to see the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Instead, what he sees is a slain lamb. Jesus always comes to people in surprising, startling, shocking ways. Ways we don't anticipate. So if we're going to recognize Jesus in our daily lives, we have to keep awake. We have to watch carefully for him. And to do that, we have to wake up. Jesus promised us, remember, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. So if Jesus truly is with us always, even to the end of the age, then maybe we can encounter him. Like I'm talking about right now. I'm talking about during this season of Advent. Maybe we can have some Jesus sightings around here. Wouldn't that be cool? Maybe we can have some Jesus encounters. Maybe we can find him. Maybe there will be an appearing of Christ in our daily lives during this season. But we have to wake up to the ongoing presence of Christ for that to happen. Listen, if we sleepwalk through life with our spiritual senses dulled by the spirit of the age, we will miss what Jesus is doing all around us right now. So what are those things that lull us to sleep? What are these sedatives? What are the things that cause us to be slumbering and not awake? What are those sleeping pills that lull us to sleep? Well, I suppose there are a lot of things, but I just want to briefly talk about three things. Three C's. I'm a preacher, so I like alliteration. Three C's. And I'll tell you what they are right now, and then I'll briefly talk about each one of them. But the three C's, the three sleeping pills that conspire to lull us to sleep, they are certitude, civil religion, and consumerism. First of all, certitude. What do I mean by that? Well, it's when we think, when we assume that we have all of the answers, textbook style, and we lose the spirit of inquiry, of curiosity. If we end up thinking that Christianity is basically about getting a good score on a theology quiz, and we have all of our opinions about various theological issues, and we're convinced that we have the right answers. In fact, we're pretty certain of it. We have a lot of certitude about the rightness of our theology. And it just quenches the spirit of inquiry, of mystery. There's no mystery. No wonder. And we cease to be seekers. We end up becoming nothing but just the doctrine police. We feel like it's our job to go around making sure everybody's got their doctrinal ducks in a row. Anybody ever got a visit from the doctrine police? I've been issued a few citations over the years myself. And we lose the spirit of adventure. Certitude is a sedative, and it puts us to sleep. Secondly, civil religion. Now, you got to let me talk about this. I got to describe what I mean here and what I don't mean. Civil religion. It's when we imagine that what Jesus is concerned with is mostly serving our national interest and our partisan interests. Now, when I say that, I'm not talking about patriotism, if by patriotism we just mean a benign sense of pride of place, proud to be from the USA, just like somebody's proud to be from Scotland or proud to be from Guatemala or wherever. I think that's a good thing. If we just mean patriotism as a benign sense of pride of place, that's a good thing. So I'm not talking about that. I'm also not talking about politics and just engagement in politics. What is politics? Well, politics, when it gets down to it, is just this, it's just how we govern ourselves, how we live together socially as a society. And I don't know about you. I think Jesus probably cares about that. And if you care about that, you'll probably have some opinions on it. But that's not what I'm talking about when I say civil religion. What I mean is when Jesus becomes a nationalistic mascot or a partisan mascot, and we think that what Jesus is really doing is serving our partisan interest, I'm just going to tell you, it makes us spiritually dull. Because Jesus is probably doing something very, very, very different from that. But you'll fail to see it. You'll fail to recognize it because you're locked into this idea of what his job description is. and it's a kind of sedative. It makes you spiritually dull, and it keeps you from recognizing what Jesus is doing right in front of you. And then the third sleeping pill, maybe the worst of all, is consumerism. Nothing dulls the spiritual senses more than the idea that life is a competitive game of acquisition. You know, we just had Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving really should be and could be a wonderful day. It could be this one day of the year where our whole society decides together, we're just going to pause the rat race for one day. We're going to exit the rat race, this whole game of acquiring and consuming. We're just going to abstain from that. And we're going to gather around a real table with actual human beings who are family members and friends. And we're going to enjoy a meal together. And we're going to spend the whole day pondering God's goodness and expressing our gratitude. That's really what Thanksgiving is. But something's changed in our culture within my lifetime. Just culturally speaking, there's been something going on in our culture. And to a large degree, it seems as though Thanksgiving has become, for many, little more than just a runway into Black Friday and into Cyber Monday. And we barely have enough time to scarf down a single slice of pumpkin pie before we feel like we got to rush out the door and go fight somebody for a flat screen TV. Something's gone wrong. Nothing dulls the spiritual senses more than this idea that that's what life is. It's a competitive game of acquisition, and whoever has the most stuff wins. Every spiritual person through the ages, from Abraham onward, they all know this. If you'll listen to the wise ones, they'll all say the same thing. When that drives your life, you're going to be dull. You're going to be spiritually asleep. You're going to be slumbering. You're going to be one of those foolish virgins whose lamps are going to go out. Now, personally, when I began to intentionally resist those three sedatives, those three sleeping pills of certitude, civil religion, and consumerism, I began to wake up. I began to have my own awakening. All three of them were operating in my life. I had to make a radical, deep decision that I was going to resist these three sedatives, the three sleeping pills of certitude, civil religion, and consumerism. And when I did that, I began to wake up. I began to wake up and be aware of Jesus in all kinds of new, fresh, startling ways. I'll give you one example. I began to become aware of Jesus' work and activity beyond the bounds of my denominational tradition. Most of you know I grew up Pentecostal. I was raised in the largest Pentecostal denomination in the world. And looking back, I would say for me personally, that was probably the best way that I personally needed to be brought up. And I'm grateful for that. There's a lot of that that still defines me today. I've left some of it behind. But it still makes up part of who I am. And so I'm grateful for my background. But I'm going to tell you, man, like back in the day, the way that a lot of us Pentecostal charismatics thought is we were like this. We were like, you know, there are probably some Baptists out there that know Jesus, but certainly not, you know, those Catholics. I mean, come on. That's our mission field. And certainly not, you know, those Orthodox people, as if I had ever met one in my life. And those Anglicans, those mainliners. You know, I just couldn't conceive that within those Christian traditions, Jesus would actually be alive and active and present. And at work, I would just look over there and I would just say, oh, that's a ghost. That's a ghost over there. And I was wrong. And when I began to wean myself from those sleeping pills, I began to get my senses back. I began to wake up and push back against certitude and civil religion and consumerism. And I began to be aware of Jesus in all kinds of ways, unanticipated ways. And I began to realize that all of these Christian streams and traditions, they all have their flaws, just like we Pentecostals had our flaws. I could tell you, I could write a book about our flaws. But I began to be aware of Jesus working and present and active in these other traditions and denominations and churches. And it was quite a surprise to me. But it was a delightful surprise. So during Advent, we here at Village Church, we're making up our mind this year that we're going to make a deliberate effort to watch for Jesus. I want us to have some Jesus sightings this year. How many of you are interested in having some Jesus sightings? Okay. Well, I can recommend some places to look. I can't guarantee anything because it's always a surprise. But if you want to have a Jesus sighting, I got a pretty good hint of the kind of places you should be looking. So I want to give you four things. I'll say them, talk about them briefly, and then we'll be done. First of all, look for Jesus in the Gospels. Immerse yourself in the Gospels. Now, as you walked in, hopefully you got one of these green sheets of paper. It's an Advent reading guide that I put together this week. And beginning today all the way through Christmas Eve, it'll give you some different readings. And as you read through these readings, some of them are in the Gospels, some from the prophets, some from other places in the New Testament. But try to fall into the story, you know. The Bible, I like to see the Bible as sort of like the wardrobe in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. When those three kids, they step into that wardrobe and all of a sudden they just fall into Narnia, a whole new world. That's what the Bible is. We understand it. It's a wardrobe. It's a supernatural wardrobe. Fall into the story. Be in the story. And it's amazing how it comes alive and how the story begins to intersect with your life. So look for Jesus in the gospel. Secondly, look for Jesus in communion. I'll be preaching on communion in a few weeks. You know, communion is known by different terms. Some people call it communion. Some people call it the Lord's Supper. Some people call it the Eucharist, which just simply means Thanksgiving. But during this season of Advent, every single service, when we come to this table and we partake of this cup and this bread, anticipate, expect, look for Jesus. He wants to encounter you in this bread and cup. Look for Jesus in the Gospels. Look for Jesus in communion. Thirdly, look for Jesus among the seekers. You know, Jesus says, seek and you will find. Ask, seek, knock. The door will be opened. And seekers are seekers. They're not people who just sit around and just analyze. Seekers aren't full of certitude because at best they know that they've done nothing more than just barely begin to understand God as revealed in Jesus Christ. And so there isn't this dullness of spirit where they assume that they already know what needs to be known and now their job is to just help everybody else know and believe as they already know and believe. You know, as much as you can help it, try not to be around those kinds of people. Put yourself around seekers. People who say, yes, I believe God is revealed in Jesus Christ, but I'm just barely getting started. There's a whole world of exploration and discoveries to make. This is a lifelong expedition. Look for Jesus in the Gospels, in communion, among the seekers. And last but not least, look for him among the suffering. He says, I was naked and you clothed me. I was thirsty and you gave me a drink. I was hungry and you fed me. I was sick and in prison and you came to me. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. Among the sufferings, the sufferers, Jesus is to be found. So look for Jesus in the Gospels, in communion, among the seekers, and among the suffering. Now look here as I bring this in for a landing. If you really, really want to have a Jesus sighting, if you really want to encounter Jesus, you can. You can. But know that there's a price to pay. Because to encounter the living, risen Christ is to be challenged and changed. I promise you. You will not encounter Jesus and have him say, just stay the way you are. You got everything right. That will not happen. To encounter Jesus is to have your eyes open, to be startled, to be surprised, to be challenged, and to be changed and awakened. And here's what I've learned. Not everybody wants to be awakened. Have you ever had the task of trying to wake up a teenager? Not everybody wants to be awakened. Not everybody wants to have their eyes open. And I'm not talking about teenagers. I'm talking about Christians. There's a lot of people in churches who prefer the sedatives of certitude, civil religion, and consumerism. But if that's really your heart, that Jesus, I'm pretty sure I don't have everything right. There's a whole lot more that you want me to see and know and experience. So Lord, help me to encounter you as you are. Remove the varnish of my own assumptions and opinions that are getting in the way of me seeing you and recognizing you. I want to see the unvarnished Jesus. Before you pray that prayer, just know what you're asking. You are asking to be challenged and changed. He's not going to say, stay the way you are. Jesus will not come to you and just confirm everything you've always known, assumed, and believed. He will come to change you and challenge you. But if you're still willing to pray that prayer, then let's join together in prayer right now as we prepare to come for communion.
Thank you for listening to today's message. To learn more about Village Church, visit our website at villagechurchburbank.org.